it's in some ways unclear what be an effective resistance to the march of authoritarianism and its appeal to many ordinary people. So I guess I'm inclined to think that it's going to be critical to try to build strong forms of group solidarity. It's only if a sufficient number of ordinary people kind of rise up in the streets and are willing to put pressure for change, are we really going to be able to reverse course. So I think that's the only real road. I don't think that, you know, Bernie Sanders or AOC are going to, I mean, they're critically important and I, you know, value what they're trying to do, but I don't think that they're going to turn the Democratic Party kind of through these kinds of events. It's only insofar as they inspire broader grassroots organizing, political education helps people kind of understand the dangers of allowing billionaires to run the country like a business.
Hey guys, hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Dissents Podcast, another one in English. Been a long time. This week on my show, Tommy Shelby. Tommy Shelby is a philosopher and professor at Harvard University, so Dissents Podcast going Ivy League here. No, but seriously. Tommy is currently residing in Germany, holding the Benjamin Chair at the Center for Social Critique in Berlin. And you guys that are longstanding listeners, you know I share history with the center. So, of course, I couldn't miss the opportunity to talk to Tommy Shelby, who is dealing in his works with racial, social, and criminal justice, and who is turning in his Benjamin lectures to the questions of solidarity and self-respect, quite important ones in these times of creeping authoritarianism and fascism, of course. So enough of the intro talk, let's get to it. Tommy, thank you so much for joining me here on the Dissents Podcast. Thank you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. Tommy, actually, we are talking before your Benjamin lectures in Berlin. I think it's quite a nice opportunity for folks here in Germany and Europe as well to learn about your body of work. For me as well, it was the upcoming lectures, my kind of first point of connection to your thought, which is quite interesting, your thought, because it's combining ideas from Black radical tradition, Marxism, as well as Africana philosophy, and especially the first two, Black radical tradition and Marxism, a kind of a part of this podcast as well. So for starters, it would be interesting to hear from you, Tommy, how your Benjamin lectures, where you develop specifically what you call a political ethics of the oppressed, how that fits into the broader context of your work. And just to give our listeners who might not be familiar with your work, just to give them a bit of context, your books, for example, deal in general, of course, with issues like racial and economic injustice and Black solidarity, but also specifically things like the ghetto experience as a manifestation of persistent racism, or the idea of prison abolition, for example. So just to give our listeners a bit of context. So for starters, maybe Tommy, you can explain a bit how your idea of a political ethics of the oppressed that you're going to develop in your Benjamin lectures, how that fit into the larger frame of your work. And secondly, can you introduce a bit the idea of a political ethics of the oppressed, explain its place within philosophy, especially the Black radical tradition, and what kind of major questions you want to raise in your lectures?
Sure. So I think of my work, my work is primarily in social and political philosophy. I think of my work as largely focused on connections between racial justice, economic justice, and criminal justice. And I've mostly written about the ways in which those various forms of justice or injustice are related. But I'm also very interested in the history of Black political thought, mostly Black diasporic thought. And I draw on the tradition of Black political thought in my social and political philosophy. So I might draw on figures from the Black abolitionist movement against slavery in the 18th, 19th century, or I might draw on figures who were very prominent during the Jim Crow era, like W.E.B. Du Bois and others, or figures who were very influential in the civil rights movement or the decolonization movement. Where that might be someone like Martin Luther King Jr. or Frantz Fanon or others. So I'm very interested in drawing on that broader tradition to think about issues of, you know, racial justice, economic justice, and criminal justice. That tradition tends to focus on not just on, as traditional political philosophy would, not just on, you know, what makes for a fully just society, what makes for a fully good society or a free society. It does focus on those issues, but most of the contributions are focused on how the members of various oppressed groups, in particular people who are Black, you know, how they ought to respond to their condition of being, you know, systematically burdened by various forms of injustice. And there's a lot of focus on not just on appropriate modes of resistance, so that's critical, but also on how to live a dignified life under conditions of oppression. So the political ethics of the oppressed is largely about that set of questions. You know, what are the values? What are the principles? What dispositions of character are appropriate to cultivate and embrace as you try to not only survive, but appropriately fight back and live with a sense of self-respect under conditions of oppression? So that's really the focus of my lectures, is on that set of questions.
Hmm. Yeah, thanks, Tommy, for that kind of intro to your work in general and to your project of a political ethics of the oppressed. We're going to return to that set of questions of solidarity and self-respect. We're going to return to them just shortly because they are also very important for our listeners, of course, coming from totally different backgrounds. I'm experiencing, in the case of racism, harsh oppression, and others like me coming more from a perspective of privilege and allyship, I say. Mm. But before we're going to talk about those set of questions, the questions of solidarity and self-respect, I first want to zoom out a bit and want to look at what constitutes injustice and oppression in your view. Uh-huh. So specifically how you think about race and class-based oppression, because coming from the Black radical tradition, as you described, it was much influenced by Marxism and socialist thinking, which are important themes in this podcast as well. So it was influenced in that sense with regard to economic injustice, the political economy, and how racism and class intersect there. But it also emphasized the role of racism and colonialism in the rise of capitalism, as well as racial oppression today. Mm. So maybe coming from that tradition, you can talk a bit about what's your approach to racial and class-based oppression.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly very influenced by Marxism and by the broader socialist tradition in a lot of my thinking about injustice is informed by that broader tradition. But as I say, I'm also influenced by a number of Black radical thinkers who've tried to grapple with understanding the modern world and what made the modern world that we've inherited. And that includes, yes, of course, thinking about the emergence of capitalism as a global phenomenon, but also understanding that the emergence of capitalism was joined with, interconnected with, explicit forms of racial domination, whether in the form of the slave trade to the Americas or the Jim Crow regime that emerged in the wake of the fall of slavery, or apartheid in South Africa, or various forms of colonialism, whether in Africa, the Caribbean, or in Asia. Those forms of oppression are obviously interconnected with economic exploitation, as is traditionally understood within Marxism, but they also include an ideology that suggests that certain groups are inferior and don't have the same moral standing as others, in particular people of European descent. Hmm. And that ideology is not just a convenient rationalization for exploitation, though it is obviously that. It also shapes the culture and interaction between peoples, and has done so for many generations. And that culture and the way in which it shapes how people of various backgrounds interact is something I think that needs its own kind of diagnosis and perhaps even distinctive modes of resistance. So when I think of myself as drawing on the Black radical tradition, I think of myself as drawing on a tradition that takes seriously both exploitation of workers under capitalism, but also various forms of race-based stratification that have existed now for several hundred years and continue to persist and have influence on the world that we currently inhabit.
Hmm. Yeah, injustices having their own logic but being deeply connected. That, of course, poses questions of how to think about solidarity and struggle, what form solidarity is taking or should take, something that you grapple with, and maybe you can elaborate on that a bit later. But I first wanted to get your sense or your opinion on a concept that's been discussed quite recently, the concept of racial capitalism, which is especially focusing on the historical role racism played in the construction of capitalism. And quite recently, there's been much debate on that concept, racial capitalism, and it's also been a reference point for social movements such as Black Lives Matter. Mm. Since I'm personally new to this, and many of our listeners, I guess, could you explain a bit this concept of racial capitalism? What are its merits in your view in adequately understanding capitalism and resisting it? And how do you personally think about it?
I mean, racial capitalism is certainly a concept and a set of theoretical debates that I'm familiar with. It's not a concept I typically invoke in my own work, though I engage with it, the set of ideas. Mm-hmm. There's a debate around the origins of capitalism and how to understand the history of capitalism, where some would insist that that history is inextricably tied to the race idea and its implication in various imperialist projects. There's stronger and weaker versions of that view. You might claim that capitalism would not have become constitutive of the global order if not for racial domination. That'd be a very strong claim. Might be true. Some would say, while not making a strong counterfactual claim of that sort, might just say it just contingently helped to create the world that we know. That is, racial domination helped to create the form of capitalism that we know, though perhaps it could have had a different history. But that's the history we've inherited, and there's not a way of appropriately resisting this particular form of global capitalism without taking seriously the history of racial domination and all its consequences. And that point of view, I'm sympathetic to and think that that's something along those lines is probably right. I mean, the notion is invoked probably most famously in a book by Cedric Robinson called Black Marxism. I don't know that a lot of people who currently embrace the idea of racial capitalism would accept everything he says in that book. You know, for instance, I mean, he thinks that the race idea and racial domination is very old. It goes back to the ancient world and is not a modern notion, as many Marxists and neo-Marxists would insist. So I don't think a racial capitalism is a settled idea. There's a set of debates about what it really means, what are its key claims, but I think fundamentally it is a claim in social theory about the correct history of global capitalism and how we should understand it, and a claim about the appropriate forms of resistance, so that you wouldn't think necessarily that international working class solidarity is going to be the full solution to the problem.
Mm, yeah. And what is, in your view? Because a lot of socialists put primacy on the social struggle, on working class struggle, and have kind of struggles for racial justice on the back burner. So there is this idea of a universal working class taking for granted and not thinking deeply enough about how to actually build it, given all the racial tensions and hierarchies within the working class as well. So how do you think about that problem? What's the solution to the problem of racial capitalism in your view?
Well, you might think there are going to need to be multiple struggles that are happening kind of simultaneously. And there might need to be an independent collective struggle against racism in its various varieties. And of course, you might think, I think rightly, that any attempt at multiracial, multi-ethnic working class solidarity is going to have to confront the persistence of racism amongst the working class itself. And that is a pretty intractable problem in its own right.
Yeah, totally. We're actually going to return to that question of solidarity, but Tommy, speaking of the right analysis and solution to like racial injustices and class injustices, I wondered how you think about and compare to liberal views of racism and anti-racism. Mm. Because for me, it seems the dominant view about racism is that it's a set of attitudes or actions of racist individuals. And this then is reflected in liberal approaches to anti-racism, which is all about anti-discrimination and representation, which is fine, but not nearly enough, I guess. I mean, it's fine to say if there's a social ladder, make it at least as fair as possible, give everybody the best chance to climb the ladder. But in reality, we just see that there's so many shitty jobs, for example, at the low end of the ladder. And, well, it's most likely going to be a migrant or non-white dealing with that sort of disadvantages and that sort of jobs, for example. Mm. So anti-racism informed by socialism should be also concerned with changing the game entirely, making the economy more equitable for all, not just for like the few on top of the ladder. But yeah, I wondered what you make of liberal notions of racism and anti-racism.
I mean, I should probably first say, I mean, I tend not to use the label liberal as a kind of negative label for my political opponents, partly because I think of myself as committed to some dimensions of liberalism. I understand what you mean. There's a kind of way that sometimes people on the left speak of liberals, and they don't necessarily mean the kinds of views that I would defend that I think of are part of the liberal tradition and its egalitarian strands. But I know what you mean. It's a kind of neoliberal conception of equality that's rather limited, right? It's a conception that says what we want is fair competition for the spoils, if I can put it like that. Let's create a society and a world where there's sharp, open, free competition for the spoils, for the benefits of cooperation. There will be winners and losers. Well, you want it to be a fair, want it to be a fair competition. And it's unfair if racial prejudice interferes with the competition. So one way of thinking about the problem of racism is to try to remove racial prejudice from that contest. And that's a very limited way of thinking about the problem, but I think it's pervasive in some circles. That's kind of what most of the people think. And so they spend a lot of time thinking about how to construct anti-discrimination law. You know, how do you prevent employers or lenders or people who rent out housing or sell housing and so on from discriminating against stigmatized racial groups or other ethnic groups and the like? And so a lot of U.S. policy around this issue focuses on that. What's the appropriate anti-discrimination regime that you can instantiate in law? Mm-hmm. I think people who are, you know, more on the left, whether they're, you know, embrace some form of black radicalism or not, think that that's too limited view of equality and justice, and think that the poor and disadvantaged working people are owed much more than a fair competition for material assets. They're owed a much fuller life and a much greater share of the benefits of social cooperation and economic cooperation, and indeed should have more say in the structure of how we cooperate for our mutual advantage. So I think it is a limited view of the problem, and it's also limited in how it deals with the impact of the past. You know, I think of a lot of the disadvantage that various racial and ethnic groups experience around the world is not due solely to ongoing discrimination against them, but it's due to the historical weight of many generations of the subjugation of their people and the very limited ways in which these societies have tried to rectify that situation and try to remove the burdens to their flourishing. So I think that's also another limitation is, well, how do you appropriately respond to the weight of the injustices of the past? And a lot of what we see currently in the United States is an attempt to disavow any need to confront the injustices of the past and how they impact the present.
Mm-hmm. talking about those limitations of liberal anti-racism, and I don't mean it actually in a derogatory sense, because preventing discrimination or having sorts of affirmative action is important, as I said. And under Trump and authoritarianism, we see how those laws are attacked and removed, actually. But what's missing from the liberal notion of anti-racism, for me at least, is social justice, where we see that so many people are struggling with their well-being, the material well-being, and many, many of them are non-whites and racially discriminated people. So Tommy, but being limited, I wondered what in your eyes would be a fuller view of anti-racism, and what role in your eyes would economic justice play? So not just being owed a fair competition, but being owed less competition, but just a fair share in the end.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, something like affirmative action was a very limited tool to try to redress socioeconomic and educational disadvantage the wake of almost 100 years of Jim Crow segregation. It is a limited tool because it largely helps a pretty small fraction of the Black population, the people who can take advantage of elite education, which is a very small portion. You know, the vast majority of colleges and universities in the United States, and I'm sure that's true in many other places, most of these places are not selective. They accept an overwhelming number of their students, in which case Black people would have access to them. Affirmative action is largely a tool used by a small fraction of these universities and colleges that are highly selective, that are accepting, say, 20% or less of their students. And that's just access to that is just going to be limited to people who have, you know, kind of pretty unusual talent and skill that enables them to have academic success. So it's a pretty limited tool, now abolished by the Supreme Court. So that was always going to be a limited approach to the problem. So I think a more appropriate approach is going to have to include, I'm not against affirmative action, I'm for it. But I think you need to add much more to it, especially things that have to do with, you know, socioeconomic disadvantage of other sorts, right? So, you know, the United States right now, there is not only enormous income and wealth inequality, but it's highly concentrated and in the hands of small few. So I think no attempt to address these kinds of problems can fail to confront the concentration and maldistribution of wealth. It gives people enormous power over the lives of others, helps them to shape the way government functions, gives them ready access to the labor of the marginalized, and so on. So any kind of anti-racism is going to have to confront that larger problem of political economy. But it's also going to have to focus on things like access to decent, safe housing, which is also a problem in the United States and elsewhere. It's going to have to make sure that not just college education, but education of our youth is of a high quality and accessible to everyone. And we don't have that either. I mean, one concrete way in which that works is, you know, people who are wealthy and affluent are able to get their children very high quality education, either through private education, which is very expensive, or even if they go to a public school, they use money to supplement that education to give them other kinds of advantages. So ordinary working class, middle class people who don't have that kind of extra money are not going to be able to get access to the highest quality education that will enable them to compete for those selective college spots. So a lot of work has to be done there. When we don't really have a proper universal healthcare system either. And again, you know, that's fundamental, people to have access to healthcare, including mental health care, to be able to flourish in life. So I think any attempt to kind of confront inequality, racial, economic, and otherwise, has got to be working on all these fronts and can't be limited to a narrow anti-discrimination regime.
Racial justice needs social justice as well, and the other way around. But maybe also more criminal justice. You mentioned in the beginning explicitly the topic of criminal justice. So I wanted to ask you a question about that as well.
Mm.
Because in the United States, the connection between racism, economic neglect, and mass incarceration of Black people, that's quite obvious. So, but in Europe as well, even though having much more of a welfare state and much less prison population, we still see the connection of migration, for example, and detention. Yeah. And given the crisis we see, I fear it's only going to intensify. Yeah, the border regime, the carceral state, and excessive policing, for example.
Mm.
And in light of that, a lot of radical activists put forward the idea of abolition. So the main argument there is that progressives or radicals shouldn't argue for the reform of police, the reform of prisons, or the reform of border, but actually for the abolition or the dismantling of these institutions. So I wonder, Tommy, how do you think about the tradition and idea of abolition, since you actually wrote a book about it on the topic of prison abolition?
Uh-huh.
And how is this idea of abolition actually connected to a strong welfare state or even a socialist reorganization of the society, I wonder, where it's not so much about having a fair competition for the spoils of society, as you put it, uh-huh. but having less competition and a better place for all?
Yeah, so my engagement with abolition comes out of, as you say, a broader concern with police brutality and violence and the mass incarceration. You know, activists and scholars and intellectuals have been, you know, writing about, discussing, and fighting around this set of issues for a number of decades now, just thinking about what seems like unchecked police violence against marginalized populations, and an incarceration system that seems to sweep up large portions of poor and working class people, many of whom are among the racially stigmatized and are disproportionately among the racially stigmatized. And a lot of people have tried to think about different ways of confronting that problem, from various reformist positions to pretty radical positions. And so I was very interested in became interested in the abolitionist approach to the problem, which suggests that the aim really shouldn't be to try to reform policing or prisons, but rather we should be trying to transform the social world that makes practices of that sort necessary, and it brings in its train the many abuses we're all familiar with.
Hmm.
And so I was interested in that point of view. I'm interested in that point of view, especially in its more left-wing varieties. I mean, abolition comes in many ideological stripes, some of them connected to socialist and anarchist movements, but some are, you know, have a more liberal stripe or pacifist stripe. So I was very interested in the forms of abolition that come out of the Black radical tradition, which include figures like Angela Davis, who's been probably the most influential philosopher in the Black radical tradition writing about abolition. And I wanted to engage with that set of ideas because I found them challenging and interesting, even if I didn't fully accept the central claims. I think they're raising some critical questions. I particularly think they're right to draw our attention to the role of the police and prisons as a mechanism for suppressing political dissent, as a means or a weapon even to marginalize political opponents. This is a longstanding use of prisons and police, of course, around the world. It's not unique to the United States by any means, but the abolitionists kind of draw our attention to that role. You know, we shouldn't treat them as just mere law enforcement, but they are connected to attempts on the part of people on the left to struggle for something, for more fundamental change, because those struggles are often defeated by the use of the mechanisms of law enforcement, or at least they're set back by that. So I think that's a really critical point and has to be grappled with,
mm-hmm.
and is very important to left-wing struggles. I myself am not an abolitionist in the fullest radical sense, because I don't myself believe that policing and imprisonment are inherently unjust practices, or that they're incorrigibly unjust. They are clearly often, even generally, unjust in practice. But I'm not on the side of those who thinks they can be readily dispensed with, even under conditions much more egalitarian than the ones we currently confront, it's not obvious to me that we could do without those practices entirely. I certainly think that we would want to shrink the footprint dramatically of prisons and policing and narrow the uses of prisons to really the only the most serious kinds of crimes that cause kind of great and irrevocable harm, the kind of thing that you couldn't possibly fix. So murder in particular, I think it's important to prevent. And I think police and prisons will play a role, hopefully a much smaller role in a more just society than it currently does. Similarly for the police, the police are overused, generally armed with lethal weapons. And again, I would think that in a more just society, they would have a much more limited role to play than they currently do.
Yeah, totally. I wondered if you just briefly could shed some light on the current political situation regarding the topic of prison and police abolition. I remember that in the wake of the George Floyd killing by police in 2020, there was this huge moment for Black Lives Matter and for the proposition of defunding the police, and it had real-world implications. So I sort of wondered, what's the development with defund the police in the United States since then? Mm-hmm. And the other thing would be, how do you look from the United States across the Atlantic to Europe? Because it's even in the United States, the marginalized idea, abolish the police or abolish the prison. But in Germany, the discourse around that is even smaller than in the United States. And it's in the mainstream, it's seen as a problem and a discourse in the United States that came from there to Europe, even though we have to a different degree also grave problems with racism and policing and imprisonment. So I wondered how you look on that, and if socialists everywhere should push for abolition as well, even though it's kind of in the mainstream perceived or branded as it's kind of ultra radical and utopian idea.
Yeah. Maybe the first thing to say is abolition is actually a very old idea, and its origins are actually on the left. These are ideas that anarchists like, Peter Kropotkin or Emma Goldman defended. Many socialists, Eugene Debs, lots of other people have defended it, well before the current moment. So I think of the contemporary abolitionist movement as picking up a much longer tradition of thought. And that older tradition of thought was very focused on, the point I made before about the role of the police and prisons in suppressing dissent, and that you have to understand it as a kind of weapon of the dominant regime. That's a very old idea in the abolitionist movement, an abolitionist tradition, I should put it like that. But also, there's a theory of crime in the abolitionist tradition, especially in its socialist and anarchist versions, which suggests that the vast majority of the crime that we see is the result of economic disadvantage, and that it's the police and prison, the police are there to contain it and to prevent more affluent people from being negatively affected by the externalities of that poverty, and they're there to contain the most unruly elements of the poor through imprisonment. So that idea is very old. I mean, and it's a part of the anarchist and socialist tradition to think things of that sort, that the prisons are, filled with economically disadvantaged people overwhelmingly. And that's not just the United States, that's everywhere. And so when you say, well, it's not that Europeans might see this as a kind of, U.S. movement that emerged out of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter. And so I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think it was a much older idea that really in some ways of European origin. As far as the current, Black Lives Matter movement, the defund the police was a particular strategy that some people were defending. They thought that if you could shrink their budgets, you might be able to shrink the footprint and maybe use some of that money for other kinds of things, including attending to the needs of the poor and disadvantaged. Whether that strategy had much of a chance of working, I don't know. But it was an attempt to try to get people to see that we're way overspending on law enforcement. And we should really think about how to use our public resources in more productive ways and in ways that actually probably do a better job of preventing crime if they were ways of improving the lives of the most disadvantaged. There's a part of that I'd certainly agree with, that, you know, we do need to do a public education and remind people that we probably could spend our money rather differently and get better results. But the police in particular is a fault line in U.S. politics, and it's very connected to issues of race. This is one of the ways in which these things are connected. And police are seen as containing dangerous Black and brown people, and attacks on the police as, you know, violent and abusive are bound up with a range of racist ideologies about non-white people's connection to the law and the threat that they are seem to pose to the possessions and well-being of the affluent. So it's pretty hard to disconnect an attack on the police with a story about the dangerousness of marginalized, racialized people totally bound up together in US politics.
Tommy, maybe we can just now finally get back to your Benjamin lectures where you tackle the question of solidarity and self-respect under racism and capitalism. You just now described the grave injustices and forms of oppression that marginalized communities deal with and the prospect of an abolitionist democracy or socialist democracy. So the prospect of liberation is so far away that, of course, raises the question how to live a resistant and dignified life as an individual, but also as a collective. So how to come together in solidarity. And that's exactly the topic that you're talking or tackling in your upcoming Benjamin lectures on a political ethics of the oppressed. So maybe you can start talking about your idea of solidarity or what are the questions that are you concerned with there? So how do you think about solidarity in the context of race and racial injustice? That would be the first question I'm interested in.
So I think of solidarity as a kind of moral ideal, if I can put it like that, an ethical ideal. It's a kind of commitment that's jointly and reciprocally embraced by people, often to defend their interest, sometimes to advance a cause, sometimes to promote other values and objectives they might have. In the political context, these forms of solidarity include people strongly identifying one another, of having a sense of loyalty to each other, attending to the worst off in the group, having a sense of trust among each other, are all ways of enabling groups to be able to engage in effective collective action cooperation. And sometimes that collective action and cooperation is focused on specific political values and objectives. So we speak of kind of political solidarity. That solidarity might exist amongst, and often does exist amongst, the various unjustly burdened group, oppressed groups who might already develop a sense of solidarity and mutual support for each other, but it gets extended to a cause for their liberation. That solidarity can, of course, be drawn on and extended to a broader cause that would include people who may not be among the oppressed group as they try to bring about some desirable end. I think when it comes to major structural transformation, I do not see a way to bring it about without strong forms of group solidarity, both among those directly affected, among the oppressed, and amongst people who are potentially allies or comrades to those who are oppressed. So those forms of solidarity might take the form, if I'm right in thinking that racial domination has to be confronted directly and can't just be seen as something that will be solved as a side effect of a socialist struggle. Then it's going to be important for there to be forms of solidarity that are appropriate to that problem, just as there need to be forms of solidarity that are appropriate to the problem of economic exploitation under capitalism. Ideally, these overlap in meaningful ways, of course. Hmm. So when I think about the political ethics of the oppressed, I think that solidarity is really quite central to what I said, to, you know, how do you engage in meaningful forms of resistance and maintain a sense of dignity under conditions of oppression? Solidarity is going to be critical to that.
Hmm. Two questions on that, actually. First, what's in your view forms identity when it comes to shared solidarity? Because in Europe here, there's a critical discourse towards identity politics. And of course, the right instrumentalizes this and they have their own identitarian and exclusionary vision. Mm. But also from the left, there's criticism that identity politics fixes people in static identities and making universalistic coalitions impossible. So that's the main argument there. And this seems to me to be a misconception, because in most cases, identity is formed around oppression or exploitation. So the conditions one is put under, and not essentialistic identity or something. Mm. And struggling together against that oppression actually is the form of identity. And in that struggle, identities transform as well. So it's kind of an open process. So if I understood you correctly, you propose to think of solidarity in that non-essentialistic terms. But maybe you can elaborate on that. Uh-huh. And the other thing would be, Tommy, you talked just now about overlapping of struggles. So forming an overarching solidarity out of difference. That is quite an important thing for any socialist challenge to capitalism. Forming this, what you earlier called multi-ethnic, multi-racial working class. So we already briefly talked about that, but I just wanted to get now your view on how you think about that challenge of connecting struggles.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the first thing I would say is the critique of identity politics comes from the right and the left. They have different flavor to them, of course, but identity politics has been attacked from both sides. I don't think of the forms of solidarity amongst oppressed groups as fundamentally about the identity of those groups. I don't think of it in those terms. Hmm. There may be a narrow band of cases where that's important, right? There are various forms of group-based oppression. Some of them are, you know, connected to a status hierarchy. I think racial oppression is. Some of them are about economic exploitation of various sorts of labor or land or resources. Sometimes the subordination of women, the range of forms of group-based oppression. Some of them, of course, have to do with hostility and prejudice toward group-based difference. And in that case, where it's religious belief or say, for example, identity is relevant in those forms of group-based oppression, because there people are being marginalized, excluded, into forced assimilation because people will not accept their difference. So, of course, in that case, identity is going to be relevant because these people want to affirm their conception of what the good life is, which includes their religious beliefs and practices. Hmm. But a lot of what people are calling identity politics isn't just that. And they're talking about all these other forms, which I don't think are really fundamentally about identity. I think they're fundamentally about groups that are dominated and exploited. And they may not be that different from the dominant group. And that's not really the critical thing. So there I say the solidarity is not based on their affirming some collective identity. It's based on their recognition of their common condition and subordination, and hopefully their joint commitment to trying to resist it and overcome it. So some of these forms of solidarity are bound up with specific oppressed groups, who will be, if you like, the lifeblood, the center of collective cooperative action to transform things for the better. Hmm. And I don't see why that should be dismissed as a kind of identity politics. I think it's critical, and it's not really fundamentally different from the working class struggle. It's really quite similar. The working class is also, I think, exploited under global capitalism. And it makes sense, as a long tradition of socialist thought has suggested, for them, in light of their common condition, to develop a joint and reciprocal commitment to fight together against it. I guess if I differ from that tradition, it's that I don't think that that's the linchpin to solving all forms of group-based oppression. Critical to it, but I don't think putting all your energy into that is going to solve all the others.
Yeah, I'm totally looking forward to seeing your lecture on the topic of solidarity. Just briefly, because the time is running, just briefly talk maybe about the topic of self-respect as well, which is of course critical to anyone that experiences oppression, because full emancipation, like a just society, that's something that's really a long-term and even an uncertain goal. Yeah. So the question of how to live like a defensible and dignified life under oppression, that's something quite important. And that's something the Black radical tradition philosophically highlighted. And you coming of that, tradition and coming of the group that experiences historical oppression until today, I wondered how you think about the question of self-respect. Maybe you can give us a slight glimpse of your lecture on that, which is going to be much more extensive, of course.
Mm-hmm. So I'll take up the question of self-respect mainly in the third lecture, the last lecture. And one thing about oppression as I understand it, I mean, this is the people who I would regard as oppressed are people who are not just negatively affected by injustice, but people who are in a kind of long-standing position of subordination, perhaps over generations. That kind of condition, you find yourself trying to figure out how to affirm your sense of equal moral standing when you're being constantly attacked as subordinate, as inferior, as your interests not really counting for much. And I think it's important for oppressed groups to affirm their self-respect through protest, because I think only through that are they going to be able to maintain a life that's not filled with shame and fear and servility as a kind of vice. I think in a lot of the Black political tradition, not only in its radical varieties, but in many of its varieties, people are preoccupied with this question, you know, partly because, you know, slavery lasted, you know, slavery of Africans lasted a really, really long time, as did the Jim Crow lasted almost 100 years. So you have people who are growing up in it, born into it, living, expecting to live their whole life under conditions of severe domination. And the question of how you do that while still sort of holding your head high and not feeling ashamed of yourself, not letting a sense of inferiority shape your soul and your psyche. That's a struggle. That's its own struggle. And I think it's important to highlight that internal moral struggle to not give in to the demands of subservience. To not resign yourself to things being the way that they are. And I think what's critical to that internal moral struggle is seeing yourself as a moral agent and a moral equal to others, though the society is structured in a way to consistently, systematically deny this. So I'm interested in that, and I'm interested in that internal moral struggle, the moral dilemmas that the oppressed face as they try to live with a sense of dignity under enduring oppression. And that's kind of much of the lectures are focused on that set of questions, but especially the third.
And what would you say is like the connection between individual and group there? Because there's also like a tension between solidarity and self-respect might constitute for certain individuals something else than for the group. So, for example, drawing value and self-respect from resisting and rebelling also comes with a lot of risks. Yeah? It comes with the risks of for one's own livelihood, for example, or even for one's life in many cases, right? So is there, in your point of view, like a moral obligation for holding up resistance in the face of injustice? Or isn't that too grave of a demand putting on an individual? So how do you think about this maybe tension between solidarity and the obligations that a group puts on an individual and also the independence of mind, individuality, freedom of expression, personal fulfillment even, that is also important for an individual. Could you maybe just talk a bit more about this issue of the tension between the demands of solidarity and personal freedom, since you're dealing in your lectures with these kind of questions as well? Because there is undoubtedly a tension between what a group demands of an individual in order to achieve some sort of justice and personal freedoms.
I'm very interested in this set of questions. They're very complex. And I agree there are tensions there between the demands of solidarity and demands the individual will naturally make to try to have a sense of personal freedom and prerogative and to try to pursue their own ends. And I think that's a delicate balancing thing. I think there's got to be space. In a lot of ways, the freedom of my subtitle is a lot of that is about the kind of freedom that I think is appropriate for the members of oppressed groups to exercise, even under conditions of injustice, a kind of personal freedom, which, you know, as they try to find a sense of meaning and moral purpose in their lives as they see it. And that might diverge from what the group might demand of them. And I think that's a critically important question and a challenge. I don't know that it's a fully resolvable in the sense that I think it is just a deep tension. But I'm also interested in trying to show that self-respect isn't just a kind of personal virtue, but it's connected to the group, at least with some forms of group-based oppression. Because some forms of group-based oppression, the group is a target of subordination, explicit target of subordination, and the actions of the individuals in the group will affect the fate of the others. So, you know, maybe people should be free to sometimes act in a servile way when, if they didn't, they face dire consequences like, you know, death, severe poverty, other kinds of things. It will be, you can't possibly expect a person to always affirm their self-respect when, you know, when the stakes are very high of that sort. Some people will do it anyway, and that will be, you know, courageous and heroic. But I don't think you can expect ordinary people to always affirm their self-respect, no matter what the consequences and penalties may be. But sometimes it's going to be appropriate to nevertheless affirm your self-respect, though there might be some risks or cost in involved, especially where your behavior is going to at least indirectly affect the fate of the group. So acting in a way to suggest that you're content with your social position, acting in a way that suggests that you do not regard your condition as unjust, acting in a kind of servile way where you act in accordance with the negative image of the dominant group has of your group. Now, these are things that all affect the fortunes of the group as a whole, make it harder for them to achieve their liberatory. They also, I think, have the effect, I mean, behaving in that kind of servile way also is an impediment to building solidarity, because it's impossible to build effective forms of solidarity with people who, you know, readily sacrifice their self-respect and engage in kind of servile conduct to win, say, small favors from the dominant group. You need people who are willing to forego some of those benefits of submission if the group is ever going to collectively achieve its ultimate ends. So I'm very interested in this set of issues. I think they're very complex and difficult. And part of what I hope to do is to help people who haven't thought as much about them to see just how intricate and challenging they can be.
I want to just know, Tommy, if that's something you deal with personally as a philosopher as well, what solidarity demands of you being part of an oppressed group that struggles. I mean, the Black radical tradition has always been part of liberation struggles, sees itself as coming from those struggles. Mm-hmm. So there is surely a tension between sacrifice for a cause and personal interest as well. In your case, how do you think about this? And another thing which is maybe interesting is, you yourself belong to a privileged segment of that group as being a Harvard professor. Is that something that you're concerned about in when you think about your relation towards solidarity and personal freedom as well? Yeah.
No, that's great. I mean, so I've heard it said once that your first book is always autobiography. I don't know if that's true, but I guess in some ways these lectures, which maybe eventually become a book, not my first, but maybe a book. I don't talk about myself in the lectures, but there's certainly a way in which I'm grappling with things that I've thought about in my own personal life as a member of a historically oppressed group, but one of the more advantaged and privileged members of the group. And, you know, what does solidarity demand of me? You know, what should I be willing to sacrifice to help the group achieve its ultimate ends and defend itself? What should be the focus of my work? You know, I'm a philosopher, I'm an intellectual, I'm interested in all kinds of questions. And I could, of course, write about all kinds of different things. I'm as interested in as many other philosophers in the great philosophical questions. I have decided, I don't think under compulsion, I think, you know, I have decided to, you know, attend to issues of injustice as the central part of my work. But even that, maybe that's totally insufficient. Maybe I should be doing much more. And that raises the question that we just talked about before, in your previous question about, well, you know, what space do I have to pursue my own ends and to do the things that will make for a fulfilling life for me? Do I have appropriate prerogative to pursue those things, even if they don't necessarily end up improving the condition of my group or helping to advance the cause of justice? So I certainly have been grappling with those issues pretty much all of my adult life. And of course, there are complicated issues that, you know, I'm a faculty member at, you know, a very prestigious university that has a lot of money. And I benefit from that, you know, and, you know, there's a question of how to use those resources that I have, how to use the influence and connections that I have to try to advance the cause of justice. These are certainly questions that I'm constantly thinking about and are themes that come up in various ways in the lectures.
Yeah, thanks so much. Hopefully there's going to be a book that comes out of these lectures. I'm looking forward to that. Before we end, Tommy, I just briefly wanted to get your opinion. I wouldn't want to miss it on the current political state in the United States. So we see that under the second Trump administration, there's like creeping authoritarianism and even fascism. The situation is quite grave, actually. Uh-huh. And when we look at the Democratic Party, at least the party's establishment, it seems not to be able to put up an effective challenge to Trumpism. And then on the left wing of that party, we see, again, Bernie Sanders, running against the windmills, and AOC in his, on his side. And they are touring the country with their Fight the Oligarchy tour. And thousands of people are actually showing up at these events. So this is something that actually gives me hope that there's going to be a moment of resistance or something. So two questions. What do you think made the rise of Trump possible? First, and secondly, do you think that Bernie and AOC can turn the Democratic Party around, or what is going to be needed in your eyes to put up an effective resistance to Trumpism?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I think even when Trump won the first time, I felt that I couldn't really trust a lot of assumptions I've made about politics maybe in the past. It was very surprised by that outcome. And I say it's partly surprised because, you know, not an orthodox Marxist by any means, but I certainly, you know, had long thought that if the broader capitalist class were in agreement against a candidate for the Republican Party, that person would not get the nomination. And that turned out not to be true. That is, that there were many people, what I would regard as spokespersons for the capitalist class, and their publications were like strongly opposed to him and were again, the second time, strongly opposed to him. And yet he still got the nomination and still won, even though there were alternatives to him that would have still given a lot of things that capitalist class would want. They want low taxes and less regulation. They want ability to keep as much of their profit as possible and so on. And those things could have been secured by a number of Republican nominees who were running. And yet none of those people could win. And it happened again, despite the fact that Trump had won. So it is a difficult challenge. I don't really look to the Democratic Party as kind of the solution to these problems. I think that they can be an important break on the worst, you know, of these problems. Mm-hmm. And in electoral politics is pretty much all we have at the moment. So, you know, I think I'm a pretty traditional leftist in thinking that, you know, you have to build more grassroots forms of solidarity if you want to see different electoral politics. You know, it's still true in the United States that, you know, a third of eligible voters didn't even vote in the last election, despite it being kind of obviously consequential. It's completely disaffected and not engaged. So I guess I'm inclined to think that it's going to be critical to try to build. I mean, solidarity is difficult to build. You know, you build it over time through political education and working together on supporting each other's projects, trying to get small victories so you can build on those smaller victories. So I think that's the only real road. I don't think that, you know, Bernie Sanders or AOC are going to, I mean, they're critically important, and I, you know, value what they're trying to do, but I don't think that they're going to turn the Democratic Party kind of through these kinds of events. It's only insofar as they inspire broader grassroots organizing, political education helps people kind of understand the dangers of allowing billionaires to run the country like a business. That, I think, is important work, and that's really the only avenue of resistance to this kind of authoritarianism, I think, that's really possible in the current moment. I just don't think that Congress will be able to check it on its own. I don't think that the courts will be able to check it on their own. It's only if a sufficient number of ordinary people kind of rise up in the streets and are willing to put pressure for change, are we really going to be able to reverse course.
So thank you so much, Tommy, for joining me here just for an outlook. I wondered what would be your advice for our listeners that are just now listening to us, people who deal with these questions that you raise in your lectures, questions of solidarity, of self-respect, and in the case of solidarity for one's own, but also solidarity for others, for other groups, mm-hmm. because the people that are listening to us here, of course, come from vastly different perspectives and social positions. So some are experiences, longstanding subordination that you talked about, and others come from a perspective of relative privilege and more of a perspective of allyship. Mm-hmm. And now we live like in really dark times, not only in the US, but also in Europe and worldwide. And people are experiencing feelings of anger, despair, experiencing hardship or hostility for taking a stand in these times. And they experience a prospect of a future that seems far from liberation. And you dealing with the questions of a dignified life, protest and struggle being an integral value and part of a dignified life and of self-respect. I wondered if there's something that guides you in these times and that might also help our listeners in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm. I guess what sort of guides me, I mean, I'm very influenced by the, not just the activism, but also the writings of Martin Luther King Jr. And I feel like, I mean, and he was very interested, not just in the struggle to end segregation and Jim Crow, which of course he played a critical role in ending, but was interested in a range of struggles, the problem of poverty around the world, the problem of war and conquest, interested in a range of justice issues and fought for those. And what people often emphasize, and I try to take to heart in moments like this, is the critical importance of maintaining a sense of hope. Because it's very, and I don't mean that in a kind of, I don't mean it in a theological register, or you could think of it as a kind of political faith. You could think of it as a commitment to work on the assumption that things can be improved, and that you don't give in to the temptation to resign yourself to the way things are and that things can never get better. I think in these kinds of moments where it's in some ways unclear what being effective resistance to the march of authoritarianism around the world. I mean, it's not obvious, at least not to me anyway, what would be an effective way to resist, you know, all this creeping fascism and authoritarianism and its appeal to many ordinary people. It's not obvious what the thing to do is. And it's easy to throw your hands up. And I think especially for people who are more privileged and in some ways are more insulated from the worst of this to just feel like there's not much that can be done. So I always, in those moments when I feel most pessimistic, I try to turn back to the writings and speeches of Martin Luther King Jr., because he never really gave in to that and always counseled not to give in to that sense of resignation and deep pessimism that is just an ever-present temptation, especially in moments like this.
Tommy, thank you so much for joining me here. It's been a privilege. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ja, ihr Lieben, jetzt noch auf Deutsch zum Schluss. Ich hoffe mal, euch hat die Folge mit Tommy Shelby gefallen. Ich fand es sehr, sehr spannend und ja, ich bin, wie schon gesagt, auch sehr gespannt auf seine Benjamin Lectures. Apropos Benjamin Lectures, hier nochmal kurz alle Infos zum upcoming Event. Nämlich Tommy Shelby wird vom 18. bis 20. Juni, ja, 18. bis 20. Juni, seine Benjamin Lectures halten on Political Ethics of the Oppressed, on Freedom, Solidarity and Self-Respect, das, worüber wir auch hier gesprochen haben. Drei Lectures sind das, jeweils von 6 bis 8 Uhr am Abend, also 18 bis 20 Uhr, und das Ganze im Haus der Kulturen der Welt in Berlin im Miriam Makeba Auditorium. Wenn ihr in Berlin wohnt oder dort sein könnt für die Lectures, ja, dann nehmt euch doch die Zeit und besucht sie. Wäre doch cool, wenn der Saal voll ist. Im Miriam Makeba Auditorium sind 950 Plätze. Der Eintritt ist frei und es ist keine Anmeldung erforderlich. Für alle, die nicht in Berlin wohnen oder die nicht dorthin reisen können für die Lectures, dazu gehöre auch ich. Es gibt am Ende eine Aufzeichnung, eine Videoaufzeichnung der Lectures von Tommy Shelby, die auf dem YouTube-Kanal des Centers for Social Critique veröffentlicht wird. Das werde ich auch dann im Nachgang der Veranstaltung dann noch in den Shownotes verlinken. Oder auf der Website von Kritische Theorie in Berlin, criticaltheoryinberlin.de. Dort findet ihr auch die Aufzeichnung, die Videoaufzeichnung von Tommy Shelby's Lectures. Genau, so viel dazu. Jetzt sei noch gesagt, damit ich diesen Podcast hier machen kann für euch und für alle anderen da draußen, kostenlos, unabhängig und werbefrei. Dafür bin ich auf den Support von einigen Fördermitgliedern angewiesen. Genau, wenn du noch nicht dabei bist, du es dir gerade leisten kannst finanziell und dir dieser Podcast natürlich gefällt, Logo, dann werd doch gerne Fördermitglied. Das geht schon ab 3 Euro im Monat. Ja, und du supportest damit meine Arbeit am Podcast, machst diesen Podcast hier möglich und auch die Arbeit der Was-Tun-Crew im Inken und Valentin vom Was-Tun-Podcast, die unterstützen wir ja auch. Und es winken Goodies und es gibt wöchentlich Verlosungen. Was es dieses Mal abzustauben gibt, erfährst du natürlich in den Shownotes und da auch alle Infos dazu, wie du Fördermitglied werden kannst. Alles klar, das war es nun auch von mir für diese Woche. Ich danke euch vielmals fürs Zuhören und würde mich freuen, wenn ihr beim nächsten Mal wieder einschaltet. Bis dann.